This episode of Strange Harbor is brought to you by Mystic Gifts in downtown Hoquiam.
This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net.
911, what are you reporting?
We got someone or something crawling around out here.
Did you see what it was? Was it a person or an animal or?
I can't tell. All I know is that my sensor light came on and I just happened to glimpse and see this thing running across the yard. A good sized man or something that looks like a man. I don't know what it was. Just that it ran across the yard and whatever it is, it's running. I couldn't catch it if I was going to chase it. Jesus Christ, you better.
Sheriff?
Yeah.
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Is he in your yard, sir?
Yeah, God, he's big.
Okay, what's he doing in your yard?
He's looking at me.
Okay. And the guy is on foot?
He's a big, real big person, that's all I can say.
Okay, but it is a person.
Yeah, I'd say it was a person or somebody really big, but he's all in black.
Is he a black male or a white male? Did you actually see whether, or was he just wearing black?
He's all black and he's big. He is big.
Strange Harbor, all things strange.
I got a strange going on out here. Something just killed my dog.
Something killed your dog?
My dog went flying through the air over the tree. I don't know how it did it.
Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. This is Strange Harbor.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, we talk about Sasquatch, UFOs, ghosts, all sorts of fun stuff. I am Johnny Manson.
And I am John Connor.
And welcome to the show, and our guest today, he's a regular here on Strange Harbor, but there's a reason for it. Former Harborite, one of the core members of the Olympic Project, Mr. David Ellis. Welcome back to the show.
Well, good evening, John. And Johnny?
You are a core member of the Olympic Project. Do you want to explain for any new listeners what the Olympic Project is and does?
Ah, okay. Well, the Olympic Project was formed, oh gosh, almost 14 years ago now, maybe 13, somewhere in there. I was not on board originally. Derek Randles and Rich Germeau started a camera trail trap organization, if you will. They had a benevolent benefactor that gave them a certain amount of money to go out and buy a crap ton of trail cams. And the notion was that at that time is that they traveled the ridgelines of the Olympic Peninsula, and so they went out and set out camera traps here and there along ridgelines surrounding the Olympic Peninsula in hopes of catching said, you know, suspicious subject that we're tracking. It had what may be termed mixed results because there was something that was of debatable issue that was captured. But as the organization grew, they became, into more things, if you will. Rich Germeau was in contact with me quite a bit. He and I talked back and forth. We were both at that time members of the BFRO. And he told me about an exciting project at that point in time, which was Melba Ketchum's DNA study. It became quite controversial in the end, but that's how I became involved with the Olympic Project. A witness that I was working with had found a significant amount of hair, and he donated that to the study. And from there, Derek and I became very close friends, and soon we were working full-time together on Bigfoot topics and subjects and expanding the Olympic Project into more avenues, more ways of going about what we wanted to do. And we were doing quite a few expeditions at that point in time where we were, Derek's quite versed in hiking and, survival skills in the woods. And, I had developed some techniques for casting and audio recording. And so we thought we had enough that we could invite people in to our, we had a study area or a place where a cabin. You know, John, you've been to the cabin before.
Yes.
So we would bring people in and show them how we went about doing our business and documentation and how to write up a report and how to, if you did find a track line, all the things that you needed to do to, you know, document it. So because we were very serious about collecting evidence and in a scientific fashion. So we consulted with folks like Dr. Jeff Meldrum and Dr. Bindu Nagel, and they kind of tutored us along on how to do things for the scientific world. So that's kind of what we've been about for quite a while. COVID has kind of taken a hit. We haven't really been out in the field for quite a while. But there is a question here that I'm going to save some of our good stuff that we have talked about at the very end. So that's kind of what the Olympic Project is about. My specialty that I've have worked very hard at becoming good at is audio recording and audio analysis.
I was actually going over the website quite a bit and noticed that you haven't released a lot of sighting data. I was wondering why OP is refrained from releasing it.
We're a niche study group, if you will. Although we have a way for you to fill out a sighting report, and we want to know all the details, but it's more of a information for the Olympic Project and the witness. We don't go about publishing that. Most of the time, the witness prefers to keep quiet about what's going on. And we do things more in-depth, longer studies. I'm talking years. Some of the studies have been 5 years in the making. We just have found that we do what we like to do, and there's not really a person within the project that is kind of the sighting maven, if you will. Because we are our niche, because we're in the Olympic Peninsula area, that's our basis of study. A lot of people want to know what's happening in their neck of the woods. So somebody from Alabama really doesn't care all that much about what's going on in the Pacific Northwest. They want to know what's going on in their neck of the woods. So for that, there is a group out there, the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, that has really kind of cornered the market on sighting reports, and that's the default and where people go. So when people come to us, it's more of a private scenario. When people go to them, it's more of a public scenario.
You said you've been researching for quite a few years, and I was kind of interested on the evolutionary path that you think Bigfoot has followed. Where did he come from?
Great question. That is a morphing answer to this particular question. From the beginning, I think the first scientific real good claim is if you follow Grover Krantz. He was a professor at Washington State University in anthropology, and he took a liking to this study of this particular subject, and he kind of followed the evolutionary path that if Bigfoot exists, it had to have a predecessor, and who could that predecessor be? And lo and behold, he found a 10-foot giant ape that they had found artifacts and fossils from China regarding this particular 10-foot ape, Gigantopithecus. And the theory was that it followed human migration patterns across the land bridge and down into North America, which seemed to fit the pattern of how it could be here. It was an explanation. And so from there, Dr. Jeff Meldrum kind of confirmed that that's a really strong possibility with his foot morphology study, showing that the mid-tarsal break in great apes mimicked the footprints of the Sasquatch, which means that it falls in the line of thinking of Gigantopithecus. But as of late, if you listen to Dr. Meldrum talk, he relates several other candidates on that branch of hominidea is the term, which is loosely defines all of the great apes and humans into one branch of the tree. And in that branch are Denisovans and Homo heidelbergensis. They're candidates for possible evolutionary patterns that the Sasquatch could have evolved from. So evolutionary patterns are now stating that there's a stronger chance for them being there than there is with just one source, Gigantopithecus. So there's many options now as we discover more and more about our heritage.
Has there been any sightings in the Grays Harbor area lately that you can say yay or nay, or anything that you could talk about without getting into too many details? Because I know that you guys don't share that type of information. It's not to expose to the world. Hey, we had a sighting on Simpson Avenue. Anyway, anything that you could share?
I haven't had too much as of late. But over the last year, there's been quite a few sightings up north between Ocean Shores and Tohola. I've got a gentleman that's been kind of keeping me updated, and there was like five or six things going on.
Has Bigfoot sightings increased over the last, 10 years?
It's hard to say, because I think people are more apt to talk about it now today with we're seeing more and more TV shows regarding the possibility of Bigfoot's existence. So it's kind of thawing the ice, if you will.
It's a little more accepted now.
Yeah, exactly. It's not such a fringe thing, to have somebody say, I saw something really weird. And, usually that's how they preface it, I'm not sure what I saw, or I'm not whatever. But they're willing to talk about it, mm-hmm. where they weren't willing to talk about it, I would say, 10 years ago. And as you go back in time, it's even less. So I've heard some people say that they think that there's maybe only 1% of sightings actually recorded. I can kind of confirm that for myself. I've had several instances where I could have probably made a report to the BFRO, but I haven't.
Can you talk about what you experienced?
Well, which do you want to start from, when I was five, or
How about more recent ones?
I've had two thermal, I would say, sightings, because I could clearly see what I was looking at. One happened near a lake on the east side of Mount Rainier. I saw something in a thermal device that had head, shoulders, and legs. In the form of a human, and it was also being observed by another person who confirmed the same thing. So we saw the same exact thing. He actually saw it first. He handed me the thermal, and then I actually saw what he was looking at. So I'm pretty convinced of what I was looking at. We had been hearing things audio-wise and with the audio device that not only myself, but another investigator, they had their audio recorder and device as well. And so that situation was pretty well documented. The other was over on the north side of the Olympics. I was able to see something that I thought, when I originally was looking at it, was an elk laying down in the bushes. I could, all I could see was this white heat blob signature And so I was kind of thinking, I was pretty sure it was an elk until it stood up. And when it stood up, I saw the head, the shoulders, arms, down to the midsection of its waist. It had a watermelon-sized shaped head that was on its shoulders. The shoulders were cartoonish. They looked like bowling balls. It was so muscular. And I was maybe 100 feet from it. So I was pretty close. So that was a fun scenario, fun incident.
What about the experience that you had with your wife? And do you want to talk about that or no?
Yeah, oh, sure. Had several. This is in Grace Harbor. There was an area that I was working with a witness. And we were, we were there with the witness. And we were in a place where we were, I'll call it a cold camp, because we didn't have a fire. We were sitting around in folding chairs. And standing up and talking, and I had my audio recorder going in hopes of catching something coming up to us. I had kind of an idea where something might advance and want to take a peek at us. I was watching my wife's expression, and all of a sudden her mouth dropped and her eyes got wide open. And I said, "Hey, what's the matter?" And she said, I just saw one. And, It was on this ledge. We were down below in an area above a ledge, and she saw it take four steps across this ledge and then duck into the woods. And the reason I know she saw one is that she could not stop remarking on how smooth it walked. She said it just glided along. And she had no idea that that was a characteristic of their walk. They use what's called a compliant gait. It's kind of like a Groucho Marx thing, over-exaggerated in that analogy. But you kind of get the idea where when you walk with a bent knee, your head doesn't bob up and down. So it really gives the appearance that you're just kind of ice skating or roller skating along. You're not pole vaulting, if you will, the way we walk. So they walk completely different. And this is, you can see this in the film of Patty, in the Patterson-Gimlin film. She has the compliant gait in her stride that has kind of the hallmark of a different gait that tells you or tells folks that you're seeing the real deal. So that was the experience number one. The other time I took her down to this same location, and we had our dog with us, and she was running all over the place, and kind of was hard to control. I did have a leash, but I really didn't want to put it on her. We took off down this one particular trail, and all of a sudden she came bolting back to us with the tail between her legs and didn't want to go any further down the trail. So I thought, okay, something's up. I know what's going on here. So I leased her up, and she was okay walking with us, but she didn't want to take off ahead of us. She's a guard dog by nature, so she was in a guarding situation now. In her mind, something was up. We continue on to this one specific area. We get to one location, and Terry says to me, "Can I try a wood knock?" And I said, "Certainly." And so I'm recording audio, and she does a wood knock. And all of a sudden, at my 3 o'clock, I can hear something coming towards us through the brush. And then I can hear at the same time something at our 12 o'clock that is coming to us through the brush. as well as something at 3 o'clock. So I think I said that wrong. I think it's 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and 3 o'clock. So we're being triangulated. Something's coming towards us. Three somethings are coming towards us. And I looked at my wife and I said, I think it's time we go. So we left and we got back to the car. And you're going to think this is crazy, but it happened enough, and I got it recorded as well. But sometimes, if they were around, they would knock when we arrived or knock when we would be leaving. Or so we're at the car, and I'm unloading, and I asked my wife if she wanted to go sit behind the stump and see if she could hear something, maybe doing a wood knock. And she looked at me and said, you got to be effing crazy. No, I'm getting in the car after, you know, what's been going on. So we get in the car and I'm just about to turn it on when something cuts loose on the other side of the road. And it had to have been 30 feet or less away from us because it was extremely loud. And it screamed for about 8 or 9 seconds. And Terry whirled around and looked at me, and she said, what the F was that? And I said, I think you know. So that was an interesting experience. So it's good to have your spouse have those things happen to them, because they're not so willing to believe you're nuts, I guess, for going out there and investigating that.
So was she into, like, Sasquatch before she was going with you?
No. We decided to go camping one weekend, and I'll be a son of a gun if it wasn't really close to a BFRO expedition. Just happened to have that happen. She wasn't too happy about that at first, but then she kind of got into it after she saw so many people excited about doing that. And then she had an experience on her own during that particular expedition that led her to believe that I wasn't maybe so crazy after all. And she wanted me to go out there and find more evidence. So it worked out.
And she's like, you go do it. Go get me the evidence.
Yeah. She's been a real trooper. And I have to say, she's batting 750 or above. So if you want an experience, you should call up my wife and say, Dave says you have good luck.
So she wasn't like a hardcore citizen scientist going out there with you. She was kind of like, oh, that's David's thing. He's my husband, whatever.
And, exactly.
And then she kind of, I'll go with you just to humor you. You're my husband. Let's go for a walk. It's nice out. Oh, my gosh, what's that?
Exactly. Yeah, no, we've had several screaming incidents while we're walking on trails.
Okay, so. Speaking of screaming, after this break, let's talk about your work with audio and the differences between the types of audio you get and how do we know it's not humans doing it or dogs or whatever. It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Mystic Gifts, in downtown Hoquiam, with a ton of different gift ideas, from handmade mystical items to tarot cards, runes, various cleansing herbs, incense burners, just a ton of really cool stuff. And when you buy from Mystic Gifts, you're supporting our local economy, you're supporting their family because the whole family works in the store, and you're supporting this show. More Strange Harbor coming up.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
This episode of Strange Harbor is brought to you by Mystic Gifts in downtown Hoquiam.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
Well, it's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. Johnny Manson here, along with John Connor. And on the phone, actually on the Zoom, is David Ellis of the Olympic Project, regular to the show. He used to live here in Grace Harbor. He grew up here, spent many years here, let's say, and he's researched the alleged Sasquatch reports in our area and audio. Now, you are, some people say, an expert in audio when it comes to Sasquatch or alleged Sasquatch. How do you know that the audio that people send you, the suspicious audio, how do you know that it's not me in the woods pranking somebody or an elk during mating season or something?
Well, there's I actually look at the audio, which may confuse some folks, but the way that I analyze audio is through spectrographic analysis. And there's software out there that converts your waveform audio into a visual with so much detail. It everything has a pattern, and it represents that pattern in hertz and time and by color and or contrast, if you will. So that there's so much detail in what I'm looking at, it's like a fingerprint. So in other words, every sound print has an identifiable source. And so when you start learning what those identifiable sources are, as you go through audio, you can recognize, oh, that's a human voice. Oh, that's a coyote. Oh, that's an owl. Oh, that is, you know, the wind. That's trees. That's somebody walking. That's a dog barking. And it even gets more detailed. So when I have that much detail, if I have a notion of what it could be, you know, if the sound is maybe canid, so you have dog as a likely subject, you have wolf as a likely subject, and you have coyote as a likely subject. So there is a place that you can go to. It's called the Macaulay Library of Sound, and you can look up, say, coyote, for instance. And they have 1,500 different audio clips of coyotes barking in various different manners. So you try to go through that and find a source that matches the audio that was sent you. And if I can't find a match, then it goes into a suspicious pile. It's not an actual confirmation that it's a Sasquatch. It's a confirmation that it's not coyote, if you follow that train of thought.
Right.
So if it's not coyote, well, what are the other possibilities? Well, we've got wolf and we've got dog. So then you go through that same analysis process. And if you come up with a canid-like sound, but it doesn't match the sound print of a coyote, a dog, or a wolf, well, that goes into a very suspicious pile. I mean, you're starting to eliminate what it could be, which is now you're kind of following the null hypothesis, so that when you remove all of the possibilities and you don't have an answer, then you can form a hypothesis about what it could be. So that's kind of the way I go about my business, and I've got several different lexicons of sounds. And the lexicon is a group of sounds that are similar that are being recorded all over North America. And I've got matches from here in Washington with things vocalizing the same way in Alabama, in North Carolina, that kind of thing. So now you're starting to form a stronger, what is it that's making these sounds? That all seem to be in areas where there's Sasquatch sightings, there's Sasquatch things that are happening around them. By that I mean, you know, they're leaving clues that they could possibly be around, and clues could include, you know, footprints. we're trying to put all of the pieces of the puzzle together, and this is just one of the tools in the toolbox.
You use Canon as an example, but is there any other animals that Sasquatch sounds like when you're doing your research in the data?
You know, that's hard to say. If it sounds like an owl, I have to default to owl. There's lots of people that are claiming that they mimic other animals, but I've got some voices that I've got recorded where they appear to be calling the dogs that live there by name, and we've got, you know, proof of it's hard to explain in a few minutes, but we do have audio of them mimicking human voices, and I'm not talking about long sentences, I'm just talking about short bursts of phoneme streams.
Right, and when they're mimicking other animals, how is it, what's different about them that allows you to identify them as not being those?
You have to see the spectrogram in order for me to show you. Mm-hmm. It's a show you scenario. I can't verbally explain it over the phone. You'd have to see the detail that I'm seeing.
You know, some Native American tribes say that the Sasquatch can mimic all the animals in the area. That's what
they say. You think about it, doesn't that make sense? And I can tell you, as a little kid growing up, my grandmother got the biggest kick out of me trying to imitate all the barnyard animals starting from about 2 years old. So it's in our nature, and if they are part human, wouldn't it be in their nature as well? And if it is in their nature, if you are a predator, wouldn't it be handy to have the ability to call things in?
That makes you worry, though, because they mimic humans.
Right.
At the beginning, at the top of the show, you were talking about a TNA project that had been done. One of my questions I was really interested in is whether or not there had been consecutive DNA samples taken, and if there was any correlating results amongst different areas of samples.
Well, first of all, it's money, 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 and more money. DNA testing sounds great until you have to pay for the test. And the deeper the dive, the more it costs. I mean, you can easily spend $10,000 to do it. So most folks out there don't have that kind of cash rolling around to do it. Not even, you know, the scientific types. So what a lot of people have done is they've gone for the cheaper route, the easier route, the mitochondrial DNA, but that doesn't answer all the questions. We've had DNA studies come back that says it's human. How much of it's human? Well, about 98%. Well, what's the other 2%? And you know that there's 2% or less between us and the great apes, right? Right now, we don't have the answers in DNA because we don't have a sample of it from a dead Sasquatch. If we had a sample from a dead Sasquatch, then we could really go down the DNA trail easier. That's not stopping people from doing it, but collecting the evidence properly without contamination. And right now, it appears that even if it isn't contaminated, it's going to be claimed to be contaminated just because nobody's going to stick their neck out and say, well, that's got to be a Sasquatch. They don't know either. So there's nuclear DNA, which is a deeper dive, which is more expensive, and then there's eDNA, which is environmental DNA, which may yield some results, but it's still back to, I think, the efficiency of mitochondrial DNA. So DNA sounds like a great, great idea until you really start getting wading into the bushes of the reality of DNA studies. So it's a possibility, but right now, I think it's a long shot.
And, okay, what are the correct ways to collect DNA? I mean, scat, does the scat have to be fresh?
No, scat, you can try collecting it with scat, but you have a 24-hour window, so you got to have everything lined up.
Yeah, the moon and the stars and the...
Yeah, right. And most people don't even have an idea who to call.
Right.
Much less have the ability to within 24 hours get the test done, you know, on the certain mucus sheddings that may be in the scat.
Right.
Maybe in the scat.
Right. And then hair, you can't get DNA from hair?
If you get the follicle of the hair, most hair samples have zero follicles. They show blunted ends, which means that the hair has never been cut. It looks like human, And when you look at it under a electronic microscope to a certain level, you can see the medulla. And the medulla in the hair, if it's clear, is not human, but everything else around the hair looks human. So that seems to be the kind of hair samples that Cindy Dolson is following. Within our group, she has the ability to identify all types of hairs, and she has a collection from around North America of suspicious samples that all fit the specific profile of zero medulla. We can see physical attributes that we can associate with an unknown human species at this point in time, but it's still, that's, you know, a long shot for science to say, well, that proves it's there's a Bigfoot out there. They would still have questions.
Right. We did live right next to Neanderthals for a long time. It would make sense that there would be a separate species of human that strayed away from us.
Yeah, would understand all about us.
Yep.
To the point of being able to avoid us with extreme capabilities. Now, if you think about it, they have taken a different tactic than we have. They seem to be able to live within the environment, and the environment seems to be our bane. We have to shelter. We have to create fire. We have to stay warmer. We are constantly fighting the elements. They do not. They live completely different methodologies, if you will, which means that they would have acquired different capabilities, abilities that we don't understand. I've always kind of thought from the very beginning of my field work, where I've had a sense that they were around, is that they know your intentions better than you do. And by that, I mean, and you can see that in dogs. When a person walks in a room and a dog doesn't know that person, they can have several reactions. And when they bristle, you go, well, why are they bristling? They know something about that person that you can't sense. It's not beyond my thought process that so would a Sasquatch have the ability to observe and understand your intentions quicker and faster than you do, and maybe be able to make a decision whether it's time to leave or it's time to, you know, observe more. They are the masters of intent.
Let's say I'm new to the area, or I'm just really interested in this. Are there areas, safe areas, that you might suggest I wander around, maybe, that I might...
You had to throw in safe, didn't you?
Right. Because everything has to be safe now. that I could go, and if I was to be quiet and pay attention and observe, I might be able to spot a Sasquatch or hear one or something.
They seem to follow streams, and the Olympic Project originated on the theory they traveled ridgelines, which makes sense. So they're high and low. I think just about any water source that may attract prey, that would include swamps, swampy areas, things of that nature. It doesn't necessarily need to be inaccessible to human intrusion. My experience tells me they know what a locked gate is. So if you have permits that allow you to get behind forested locked gates and then follow a stream and then seem to always follow along clear cut, you know, along the edges. If you listen to subtle things, like if you don't know what a wood knock is, I would suggest that you go online and try to see if you can find audio that would include a wood knock so you have some sense of what that sound is. When they're being stealthy, they seem to use that as a form of communication. That way you kind of have an idea that they're around. I would also suggest that you have an audio recorder going if you're interested in an area. Oftentimes when you're walking around, you're distracted, you're not hearing everything. And I can tell you that through looking at my audio, I have missed things that happened around me.
that if I hadn't recorded it, I wouldn't have known that they were happening. So that's a good idea. Take a recorder and have that on as you're traveling. Don't turn it on after you hear something. Have it turned on so you can record something.
Right.
There are a lot of different sightings all over the world, like with the Yeti and the Yeren and the Yowie. Do you think they're all the same thing, or at least close?
Well, I think there are certain divisions within, and you can see that in some of the types that have been described around the world. Some are smaller, some are larger. But interestingly, Dr. Jeff Meldrum went to China a few years ago and met up with a man that claimed to have a Yeren cast. And when Jeff looked at that, he said he was overwhelmed because it was the same dimensions, the same foot morphology, displaying the mid-tarsal break, which is where the heel and the mid-foot separates from the front of the foot. There is a specific break that is identifiable in Patty that was identifiable in this particular cast. And the gentleman that cast that had no knowledge of Patty. He didn't know what the Patty film was or never heard of it. He lived in China all his life. And so there was no way for him to have made this particular cast in the form of Patty. So Jeff was taken aback at that, where this Yeren displayed the same foot morphology as Patty in the Patterson-Gimlin film. So that was quite a striking thing to find. So, yeah, there are certain patterns and that are collected all over the world. They have some similar sounds. So, yes.
We've talked a lot about what Bigfoot can do, like mimicking sounds and everything. Makes him sound either like an omnivore or a carnivore. Is Bigfoot dangerous?
Well, it is an omnivore. There are not reports that I am aware of where they eat people. So I don't think that that's a concern. What I have heard many numerous reports is, like great apes, they will do a bluff charge. If they want you out of the area, there are numerous reports of people being frightened out of the woods with something, and they always seem to parallel. You stop, they stop. You go, they go. They don't actually show themselves, but they make enough commotion where you get the notion that you better leave. Something is not happy with your presence. And, you know, that type of behavior is not something that you would associate with, say, a large predator like a bear. You know, a bear is going to make its presence known and is going to be visible. Whatever is doing this is not showing themselves. And they are tracking with you until you get to the location that they feel safe that you're out of their area.
Have you ever met people that have had, like, really negative experiences with Sasquatch? Intimidation, those bluff charges, have you met and talked to people that have experienced that?
Well, we were, my wife and I, that one story that I told you where we were being triangulated, we felt like we were being asked to leave.
Yeah, and that's when you said, we got to go?
Yeah.
You get that vibe?
Yeah, you do. You do. You know, I've had several different vibes. In this particular circumstance, it was just, and maybe it's because I was a little bit more used to this scenario at that point in time, that there's a possibility of them being out there. But I've had what I call the dreads, which is worse than the worst fear you've ever felt. I've been scared before, but there's a specific fear that goes beyond that. And I can't explain it anymore. There isn't any words in the English language that can describe this amount of fear. So when you get that, you're out. You're out of there.
my first experience with it, I was working in the Forest Service, and I didn't know about Bigfoot being in the area at that point in time. I wasn't concerned about that, but all of a sudden, I had a chainsaw in my hand. I was cutting brush, and something gave me this dreaded feeling to the point where my mind was saying, you got to drop the chainsaw and run. And the only thing that kept me in my place is I was on a line with other workers, and I wasn't about to drop my chainsaw and go screaming through the woods. As bad as I wanted to, I couldn't. But as fast as I got that feeling, it was like somebody hit a light switch and it was gone. And everything was back to normal. It was the strangest thing.
Wow. Where can we learn more about the Olympic Project?
Olympicproject.com. We're on the Internet. We have a website presence. There are some articles. And our Isaac Tien teamed up with Dr. Jeff Meldrum and Bill Munns and has spruced up the Patterson-Gimlin film to the point where you can see way more detail than you've ever been able to see before.
Like muscles and things?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, specific muscle groups.
Right. It's hard to do that in a suit.
Yeah. Yes.
No?
No. Yes. Not to be confusing. It's right. Impossible.
Right.
And that's what Bill Munns, he created the creature from the Black Lagoon. He knows from suits. He came on the Bigfoot scene in the mid-2000s, and he was going to prove that Patty was a suit. And the more he got into it, the more he couldn't do it. And he got to the point where he went, my God, that's a real creature. And he came full circle. So if you don't know much about Bill Munns, get on the Internet and brush up on him. Dr. Meldrum is a big fan of Bill Munns, and now Isaac has come along with artificial intelligence and has been able to clean up the Patterson-Gimlin film to a state that it has never been.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. David Ellis, thanks for always being kind of on call to be on the show with us.
I love it. You know that. I love being with you, so I appreciate it.
Well, and we love you, too. Hope to have you in the studio soon. That'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. Make sure you go check out our show sponsor, Mystic Gifts in downtown Hoquiam. They have tarot cards, runes, items for religious purposes, crystals, just a whole store full of cosmic coolness. Go tell them you heard about them on Strange Harbor. You guys have been so cool with supporting our little show here. So go support our sponsor, who's also supporting our show now, too. It's Mystic Gifts in downtown Hoquiam, right across the street from the ice cream shop, okay? And make sure you log on to strangeharbor.net.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.